Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Angelo Armenteros. This is Eddie Caballero. We're from Greenberg Traurig, and we're here to talk today about disaster recovery. We implemented what we hope is an interesting disaster recovery solution using VMware and some other tools, and we'd like to share it with you. We're going to go over who we are, what we're doing, some of the challenges that we face in doing DR, what our earlier DR attempts look like, what some of the design goals for our current DR platform were, and then go into the details of how we did it and what lessons we learned in rolling this out. So a little bit about us. Greenberg Traurig, if you haven't heard about us, it's a tiny little law firm based out of Miami. There's about 1,500 attorneys, 29 offices, and that actually works out to be about 30-plus sites because some offices are actually multiple physical sites. Most of the offices in Europe are in the U.S., some in Europe, some in Asia. Do lots of different things. 1,500 attorneys, as I said, about 3,500, actually closer to 4,000 people now. And we're a pretty fast-growing environment, so it's a very dynamic environment. Things are changing very rapidly. So, talking a little bit about some of the things we were looking at when designing a DR environment. First of all, I just want to point out that that picture of the trees there, that's what it looked like outside my window in Florida for Hurricane Wilma a couple years ago. Something close to that. Actually, very close to that. GT is a very highly distributed environment for many reasons, most of them not being technical reasons. Each office is designed to operate independently so they can stand on their own. We have two data centers that back each other up. We have a wide variety of WAN links. And I also should add that the remote offices vary in size from 20 people in some locations, small locations, to over 600 in the large ones. So we have a wide variety of environments and platforms that we're trying to support. The WAN links mirror that. Single T1 in some cases, 200 megabit between other offices. We have a mixture of transactional and non-transactional data. We're mostly a Microsoft Windows shop. We're all a Microsoft Windows shop. So the databases that we use are SQL and Exchange. We have Windows-based file servers, domain controllers, print servers, BlackBerry servers, proxy servers, etc.
Just want to add, completely virtualized. All you see there is completely virtualized.
That's a good point. So our 99 or 95% of our environment is running on ESX, some flavor of ESX, either 2.x or 3.0. 85 to 90 physical boxes and about 600 virtual machines throughout all the offices. All the primary components in all the remote offices are running on VMware. So what did our previous DR environment look like? And actually, I should have had probably one more slide here. We started out like everyone else did. We had backup to tape, and if something went wrong, we tried to restore the tape somewhere. We hoped the restore worked, and we hoped that whatever we were able to restore would be able to stand up as a file server and work. We did ESX about 3.5 years ago, and the primary goal, the primary reason for rolling out ESX to all the offices was simply server mitigation, not having to buy all the servers and all the remote sites. DR really was an issue. Later on, it became apparent that VMware really lends itself greatly to facilitating DR, and so we started looking at how we can enhance our DR capabilities with VMware. So the first thing we looked at was software-based replication. And there are a number of software products out there. I have to preface the rest of this by saying I still think very highly of the product that we use for software-based replication. It worked great. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. The issues with software-based replication are these up here. They're just inherent to anything that runs, any software product that runs inside the host. So it consumes guest resources, primarily CPU and memory. There are potential conflicts. There's real conflicts with the existing pieces of software. The biggest things that we saw were the backup agents and the antivirus. All of the software-based replication software that I'm aware of installs itself as a file system driver inside of Windows, and anything else that uses that same technology is a potential conflict, and so we've run into that a couple times. With the product we were using, certainly at the time we were using it, it was not easy to replicate the entire guest. It was very good at replicating the data. It would not necessarily replicate the entire C drive in a bootable format where we can just take that thing and boot it at the remote site. Another problem we had were, so I call this excessive remirror events. there are a number of factors that can cause you to have to resynchronize the data. And let me clarify the difference between remirror and resynchronizing. So the first time you put two data sets together, it copies it block by block to the other side of the DR site. If certain things happen, it doesn't have to copy all the data again, but it has to check that they're both in sync. It has to look for any change that happened in between. And in the case of the software-based replication scheme, the things that caused that the most were basically host reboots, if you're rebooting the OSs. So if the source server rebooted or the target server rebooted, it would cause you to have to resync them. Later on, towards the end of when we were using this, they upgraded their software, and you no longer had to resync if the target was rebooted, but if the host rebooted, you always had to do that. And it makes sense, because the host reboots, you don't know if something happened, if something changed your data. So you have to go and you have to take the most conservative course of action and go through and check all your data and make sure it's good at the other end. So that was sort of annoying for us, especially when you're doing patching and other maintenance operations, having to resync that data all the time. And we actually got into a couple situations where we have 8 offices in Florida as a hurricane is approaching, and we had to do something to the server that caused a reboot, and all of a sudden we're panicking because now we're having to resync this data and we're not sure if we can do it in time before the hurricane hits. So that was very concerning for us. The failover failback has varying levels of simplicity when you're doing this. You have to tinker with a lot of things on the replicated guest to make it come back up in a DR mode. Now, the products have various automation facilities for eliminating some of that, various scripting utilities and such. However, it's still there. You're still tinkering. There's a lot of things that are going on, and that's not ideal as some disaster is either after a disaster occurs and you're under pressure to get your stuff up, or you know something's coming. In our case, as the hurricanes are coming, we're preparing to move our data around. We don't want to be tinkering with this stuff. Timing is always an issue. So failover in this scenario always required us to have a standby host, whether it was physical or virtual, really didn't matter, but we had to have some sort of target sitting there running, waiting for the data to get there, or accepting the continuous stream of replicated data. And that consumes resources, and it's a management issue. You have to make sure it's patched and all other good things like that. And the last item is similar to the previous one, where there's a lot of different ways you can set up the software-based replication. You can do one-to-one, where one's waiting for where there's a source and a target, and they're always waiting for each other, ready to fail over. Or you can do many-to-one, or I should say one-to-many, the way we were doing it. No, many-to-one is correct. So we have many offices going to one replication target, but then when you go to stand that thing up in case of DR, you have to shut it down, all the other replications stop. There's a lot of issues with that. So we wanted something that was a little simpler than that, that would let us sleep easier as these disasters were approaching us. So the design goals for this were a very quick failover and failback, and making that failover and failback transparent. We didn't want to have to touch the servers whatsoever when we did the failover. We didn't want to have to change the clients in any way. The clients shouldn't have to know a different IP address. They shouldn't have to know a different server name, etc. Another thing that we learned from the software replication days where we wanted, you know, VMware does a great job at encapsulating your servers. It puts them all in one nice little unit, whether it be a VMDK or RDM or however you put your servers together. So we wanted to take advantage of that. So it was nice if we could just take that whole thing and replicate it somewhere else and just boot it. And that was really the goals that we wanted. So what we wanted was the equivalent of cold migrate that you can do now with Virtual Center, for example, but we wanted to do that across the LAN. The other big thing that we wanted is we wanted to get rid of all the interactions that were happening at the guest OS level, conflicts with the backup and the antivirus software. So we wanted the OS to be completely unaware of what was going on. And the last thing we wanted, and this last one there's no right answer to, but there's a couple different ways you can replicate data. You can do continuous replication, or you can do point-in-time replication. The important thing is, depending on how you do that, you're either going to get crash-consistent data, which is, you know, just shut off the box in the middle of replication or in the middle of operation, or you're going to get transactionally consistent, where when you boot up the box, it thinks it had a clean shutdown. Okay. And again, in the case of disaster, the last thing you want when the guns to your head is be worrying about, well, do I have to run ESC util or IS and tag on my Exchange databases or DBCC on SQL? So some of the tools that we used for implementing this, VMware 2.x, and DC1.x. As I said earlier, we are now running on, we're deploying 3.0 and starting to do some migration, but at the time this whole thing was done with 2.x. For storage, again, we've got a wide variety of offices. A 20-person office is not going to have a SAN, so we have SCSI arrays in those things. The medium-sized offices have either SCSI arrays or very low-end SANs. The larger-sized offices have big SANs. We have SANs from different vendors. Finding a way to get all this data to replicate consistently was a little bit difficult. This is easy if you have a couple of SANs and they're both from the same vendor and you can make them talk to each other. But if you have a lot of different storage pieces out there, it's a little harder to do. So we looked around, and the concept of storage virtualization came up. And we'll talk about that more in a minute, but that made this whole process a lot easier. Networking, we'll go into the details of the wall, why the layer 3 routing switch made things a lot easier for us. We used some scripting tools to make this thing all a little more seamless. And then finally, when something goes wrong, the users are using Citrix and Outlook Web Access, among other things, to access the data. So let's look at the details of how we did this. So this slide is probably representative of what a larger percentage of the offices look like. There are one or more ESX hosts up there. They're connected to the storage virtualization appliance, and that connects to the back-end storage. This back-end storage can be anything. It can be a SCSI array, SAT array, SAS array, anything you want it to be. Each office, as we said earlier, because of mostly cultural reasons, is meant to operate independently from the rest of the offices or the core network. So every office has a domain controller, SQL Exchange, file and print servers, document management servers to store the DMS metadata, proxy servers, SMS to do the workstation patching, etc. A lot of other stuff is out there. A typical deployment out there is a typical office is probably 10 to 12 servers, probably closer to 12 now. And an office has anywhere from 2 to 5 physical servers at the site. And the reason for 2 is, we started out in the early days, we only had 1, and we were just hoping that nothing ever went wrong. But the reason for 2 now is, if something goes wrong with one of the physical boxes, it's very easy for us to use VMware, fail everything over in the local site, and keep running in, at best, a degraded mode. Things are a little bit slower than normal, but everyone's running. Now, for DR, and we'll talk about this point a little more in the next few slides, it's very important to identify what data you care about, because there's a lot of expense involved and effort involved in replicating your data. So we went through and looked at what we cared about, what it took to create to replicate the end user experience at a remote location if something goes wrong. So in our case, it's SQL Exchange, the file server, the document management system, and a few related files or servers. So again, for storage, we had a wide variety of things out there. And it was hard for us to come up with a scheme. That's why we originally chose software-based replication, because that made it easy. Didn't care what kind of storage you used. So it was hard for us to come up with a scheme of how do we achieve all other design goals and still use some sort of storage-level replication. So we looked at a couple different solutions. We eventually chose IP Store from Falcon Store. And the main reason we chose it is replication. The other things, and we'll get into that on the next slide, are just added benefits. The number one reason why we're looking at it from day one is replication. When you look at replication, the two ways to do it are continuous data protection or snapshots. And again, there's no right way to do it. This is going to depend entirely on what your recovery point objective are. If you're doing snapshots, for the moment we've chosen to do snapshot replication. Why? Again, because we want to make sure we have transactional integrity of our data, in particular SQL and Exchange. Now, actually, that is a concern for NTFS as well. It's a journaling file system, and if you shut it down cold, there's a pretty good chance it's going to come up. It certainly has come up every time we've tried it. With the way we're doing it, there is actually it will get transactionally consistent snapshots of NTFS as well. And so when we boot up the server, we have a very high level of confidence it's going to come up clean. However, that also means that there's a small window of time that we don't have replicated data, and we're willing to live with that right now. If that doesn't work for you, another option to do replication is CDP. The downside to that is all your data is crash consistent. Now, a lot of different vendors, and certainly IP Store, has a mechanism by if you're doing CDP, if when you go to stand up your data, you can roll back and forth through the replicated data and find some recovery point where the data is operational. But it's still crash consistent, so you're probably going to have to stand this thing up and potentially run ETLIS and PEG, things like that, on your databases, make sure they're okay. Just a note on storage virtualization. How many of you are using some sort of storage virtualization out there? Big group, okay. So if you haven't seen it, what this does is, at its very lowest level, or its simplest mechanism, is you take some storage virtualization software, you put it in front of whatever storage you have, and let's keep it simple. Let's say it's a SATA array. You just turn this SATA array into a SAN. As far as your hosts are concerned, so the back end is like SCSI or some other connection to the physical array. The front end, you present fiber channel to your hosts. As far as your host is concerned, you just created a SAN. And you can do all the things you can do on a SAN. You can do snapshots, you can do cloning, mirroring, replication, you can do synchronous replication, synchronous mirroring, asynchronous replication, etc., continuous replication, or periodic, which we're doing. So for a very low price point to get into this thing, you can turn any storage you have into a SAN. The more important reason to do it, if you have a bunch of different types of storage out there, is you can take all your different types of storage and to your hosts, make it look like the exact same thing. So now you're managing all the different pieces of storage you have anywhere in your enterprise with one interface. And your hosts look at it as one interface. And when you're doing DR operations or any other operations, now you can automate them because you have one platform to target when you're doing scripting or any other automation mechanism. So how many of you out there have ESX connected to a SAN? Okay. How many of you are using or doing snapshots on those SANs?
At the long level?
And how many of you are using RDMs instead of VMFS? Two hands. Okay. Maybe three. So if you're not doing snapshots, snapshots are a great way to reduce your recovery time. However, there's a couple considerations when doing snapshots. And so what I'm doing here, this is a plug for all of you. I'm trying to convince you that RDMs are the way to go, and I want you to help me convince the VMware people that RDMs are really important, because I think this is going to become more and more important in the future, doing snapshots and this type of storage virtualization, replication, and things like that, and it's much easier to do with RDMs. Why? Well, RDMs are a pain to manage, which is probably why most of you aren't using them. There are limits in ESX to using them. I forgot what the hard limit, 255 per host. But if you're doing any kind of DR or multi-presentation, you're going to cut that number down as you're presenting multiple LUNs to those hosts. VMFS, it obviously, is a lot easier to manage, but there's one big problem with VMFS. If you're doing snapshots, so let's take, for example, you have a VMFS LUN, a 500 gig LUN, it doesn't matter really the size, and on that LUN, you have 10 VMs on DMDK files. And one of them is a SQL server. And you want to take a snapshot of that SQL server. Well, if you take a snapshot using your SAN software or any other software, even if storage replication software or virtualization software, doesn't matter, when you take that snapshot is now tracking all the IOs for every other VMDK file that's on that VMFS. So it's consuming a lot of IO resources on your storage appliance, and it's taking a lot more storage resources for the snapshot than you would have normally if you were using an RDM. You don't care about all those other IOs. You only snap it for your one SQL server, but the snapshot is tracking all those other IOs. So to do these sorts of operations, RDMs are a lot more useful. When you take a snapshot of an RDM, that's the only thing that gets tracked in the snap cache. So, and then your storage platform is only having to track that many fewer IOs, so it really helps with resource utilization. The other nice thing about RDMs is now you have this snapshot somewhere. If you want to recover, or if you even just want to test it, if you want to do a backup, it doesn't matter. You can take that RDM and present it either to another ESX host, which you can do with VMDK, or, and this you can't do with VMFS, you can present it directly, in our case, to a native Windows host. And it just, as far as the Windows host is concerned, it's a local drive. It doesn't care. It comes right up. So it gives you a little more flexibility, both in recovery operations and in test dev and troubleshooting scenarios. So my shameless plug for one of our needs that I hope that you guys take on the banner for is ESX needs better RDM management. The biggest problem we've encountered, and we'll talk about it more towards the end when we talk about conclusions, is that when doing this sort of DR with RDM, it works fine. The problem is that RDMs are only unique at the SAN level. If you move an RDM from one SAN to another, meaning from one data center to another or from a remote office to your data center, ESX has no idea who that RDM belongs to. And it would be really, really nice if virtual center slash ESX slash whatever could know that these RDM runs could be globally unique and track through virtual center so that when you present it somewhere else and go to bring up your VM in a DR situation, it just happens to know that this RDM belongs to this VM and associates them and everything happens transparently. So right now it doesn't exist and we've come up with some mechanisms to handle that, mostly through scripting. So networking, another one of our big design goals was that we did not want to have to make any changes whatsoever to our servers and or clients when we were doing the cutover for DR. So we thought long and hard of how to do this, and the answer became fairly obvious. Well, if we just had VLANs, and these VLANs were freely transportable anywhere on the network, we could put the servers, I'll do an example in our West Palm Beach office. We could take the server subnet for the West Palm Beach office, pick it up and move it anywhere in our organization, and nothing would require any changes. Our routing protocol would take care of redistributing the routes all over the network, and the servers would come back up with no knowledge of that anything has happened to them, and the clients do the same thing. As far as the only change that happens is that there's a routing change on the network. So what do you need for this? You need at least a layer 3 routing switch. We have layer 4 routing switches. You need to be able to subnet every office, and we do. So what we do in our offices are we use a Class A subnet subnetted down to Class Cs. So we have a dedicated Class C subnet for the server, something different for the printers, various user subnets, et cetera, and you put things in all sorts of different subnets. You need a dynamic routing protocol, and you need to come up with an addressing scheme that you can move these things anywhere, they're not going to conflict with each other. And then, now all this stuff can be done manually, but again, when something happens in the dark of the night, you'd rather not have to remember how you made all this thing happen or crank out a book and start reading and remember how all this stuff worked. So we looked at various ways to make this thing easy. There's a lot of ways to script it. There's, I'm sure you each have your favorite scripting language to automate stuff. Something that we came across that I just thought was interesting and I'd like to share is, how many of you have heard of Tickle, TK, slash expect? A couple of you. It's not very popular. But expect is a module for Tickle TK, and what it is basically a scripting language that really facilitates scripting anything with a CLI. And it doesn't care what it is, and it doesn't care whether it's local or remote. So you can script something via Telnet or SSH remotely, like a router in our case, which is why we're looking at this thing. You can script local command line utilities, like, for example, your CLI for your SAN. So you can provision LUNs and take snapshots and present snapshots to hosts and things like that. And the nice thing about this is, so we had three things that we had to control. We had to control an ESX server, we had to control our storage virtualization appliance, the IP store box, and we had to control our routing switches. And there's other APIs for most of those, but for the switches, it's just a CLI. It's the iOS CLI. So we came up with something that let us do all of them from one place, and that TickleTK happened to be it. So after the failover, what happens? Well, the nice thing is, because of the way we did this, there are no changes to the servers, no changes to the clients. All the names are the same, the IP addresses are the same, there's no DNS registrations, we don't have to wait for DNS to replicate and propagate out to the network. The only thing that gets changed is a network route, and in our case we use RIPv2, and within a couple minutes that gets propagated to throughout the network. On the remote side, as far as the users are concerned, so in this case, this is assuming that there is a true disaster and the only way the users can get into the network is using the remote access methods. In our case, we use Citrix Secure Gateway, moving to the Access Manager in the future, Presentation Server 4, and that's probably the primary way most users access the systems. Some users that don't require a desktop access just use Outlook Web Access. And for very special people, we do offer limited VPN access, although we don't like to do that, but some people are more equal than others. And the one thing that I left out of this is, the nice thing is that there's one more method of access, and simply if all that happened was a problem with the servers and everything else is fine, the users on the home office, on the remote office, can continue to access these servers natively exactly the way they did before, because all we did was move the server VLAN somewhere. The clients don't care. They just keep accessing it. Now the server all of a sudden magically wake up and, oh, the server's across the LAN, so it's taking a little longer to access the server. But if they're still in the office, let's say we had a server room fire or something like that, they can keep accessing all the systems right from their desktop the way they did before. So that makes that a lot easier. So let's go into detail of the failover process, and this is literally what it looks like. So the top half of this is what happens when we have a planned failover, and the bottom half is this happens no matter what. So if we know something is coming, and in our case, we do this, our primary reason for doing this is we know a hurricane's coming, we have some buildings have to be evacuated, they shut down power, things are going to happen like that. So we have some advance notice. We shut down the VMs in the local offices, the source VMs. We then shut down our ESX servers. And then because we're not doing CDP, we're doing snapshot replication, we flush anything that hasn't replicated up to that snapshot interval. We happen to be using 15-minute snapshot intervals. You can choose anything you want. Just depends on how often you need to do your snapshots. So once we know all the replicated data has been flushed, we shut down the VLAN, the router interface in the remote office. And then after that, the same thing applies no matter what happens. Let's say instead of the normal orderly sequence of events I just described, the office catches fire, or the office loses power in the middle of the night, or some other unexpected event that you can't plan for. The rest still applies. You go to your data center. We activate that VLAN interface for that office in the router. We present the replicated data to the failover host. These are just a couple of ESX hosts that are sitting in the data center with nothing attached, just waiting for something to come up. And then we perform anything else that needs to be done to make this thing complete. Now, in a perfect world, we shouldn't have to do anything at this point. If that magical RDM support that I described earlier existed, the VM should just be able to come up because it had the ESX knows that this VM belongs to this RDM and it matches them together and makes it come up. That doesn't exist now, so we have to go through, we have to create the RDM pointer and optionally tweak the VMX file so it knows that RDM is there. Now, we've actually learned to get rid of that last step because if you have very consistent naming conventions between your offices and you put things in the same storage paths everywhere, when you fail them over, the only thing you'll have to do is fix the RDM pointer and everything will boot up. And then the last thing you do is you boot the guest OS and it wakes up not knowing anything happened. It thought it got shut down in the office and brought back up right in the office. The key things with replication, as we learned as we were going along this, the biggest one is probably know your data change rates. How often are messages writing to your Exchange stores? How fast are you writing to your SQL databases? What's the record size? So, you know, what's the aggregate amount of data you're writing to it? Equally as important is identify and separate your critical versus non-critical data. You don't want to be paying for WAN bandwidth that you don't need. You don't want to be consuming, even if you have plenty of WAN bandwidth, or still your users want to use it for other things. They don't care about replication. That's supposed to happen magically in the background. They don't care anything at all about that. So you want to minimize as much as possible what you're going to replicate. So figure out what's important to you and what's not important to you. The WAN capacity is obviously important, but what isn't quite so obvious is the WAN latency. We have 100 megabit lines in some cases from LA to our data center on the East Coast, and that doesn't mean anything if the latency is high. The next slide will show you what I mean by that, but latency is very, very important. If you're doing data compression, how compressible is your data? That can vary widely. Sometimes you can't get any compression at all. Some things compress very, very well. Storage capacity, you need to plan for whatever storage you have now. If you're going to start doing replication and or snapshotting, you have to plan for how much that's going to take at the other end. So you have to, after you identify your critical data and you know, you add up what all those values are, you got to make sure you have that at your remote location. The other thing that you have to take into consideration is, so this next item is actually two items. When you take snapshots, or if you're doing continuous data replication, and whether that's hardware or software-based, it doesn't matter. Remember, what's happening here is these replication engines are looking at every single I/O that your applications do. And for the most part, they do it at the block level, 4K blocks or whatever your block size is. And every one of those writes, every time there's a write, that write is copied somewhere else. So every time you have a write, you've now just doubled your write I.O. bandwidth. And that those writes, unless you're doing synchronous replication, which is really rare across long distances, those writes, you want to be able to cache them somewhere because you want to be able to survive small hiccups. If your WAN goes down for 5 minutes, you don't want to have to start resyncing this thing from scratch. You want something to cache those deltas. If you exceed temporarily because you have someone copied a DVD onto your file server, if you exceed the temporary capacity of your WAN links, you want that to be cached, and then you want your replication engine to make up that in the downtime or in its free time when it has excess bandwidth to copy that out. So you're going to have some extra amount of storage to do this, so it's going to require some thinking. When you're in failover mode, the same thing applies. So in our case, let's say we take a remote office, we fail it over to the data center, and that office is down for a couple of days for whatever reason. There's two ways to handle that. When that office comes back up, if you weren't doing anything, you're going to have to remirror that data from scratch, byte by byte, to the other end. That could be a terabyte, and that could take a very long time. Now, most of the replication mechanisms allow you to, it will track those IOs, like I said, in the cache, but you have to have the disk space for that. So the better way to do it is you have enough space so you can cache all those IOs that were happening during the weekend or however long it took you to get your office back up. And then once the office comes back up or the WAN link comes back up or whatever it was that caused you to initiate the DR situation happens, you want to take those cached IOs and replicate them back in the other direction. That's going to be a lot less, whatever that is, it's going to be a lot less than the terabyte or 2 terabytes or whatever it works out to be in your remote location. So you want to have extra capacity for that as well. And the last item related to all of those, again, RDMs. RDMs will let you isolate just the IOs you care about. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about here. So for example, let's say an Exchange server. An Exchange server has a boot drive. It'll have a transaction log drive. It'll have a database drive. You'll probably have another drive for the MTA folder. And there's a couple things that you also want to consider. Well, the boot drive may or may not have your page file. You probably want to create another drive for the page file, put the page file on that, and then repoint your temp folder into that other drive, same drive as the page file. Why? There's absolutely no reason why you should be replicating all the IOs that go to your page file or to your temp folder. You may not even want the IOs to go to your MTA. The only thing you're going to want are the IOs that are going to your log and data, and you want to replicate your boot drive so the thing will boot in the remote location. And there's no right answer on how to do that, and for each environment it's going to be a little bit different, but you want to make sure you're only replicating the IOs that you need. Now, this is what I talked about earlier. This is just a graph that I found somewhere that showed the effect of latency on a WAN link. And the takeaway from here is look at the slope of those lines. It's dropping dramatically. So when your latency is down here at 5 milliseconds, you get a lot of bandwidth. But your latency goes to 40 milliseconds. Look how low it is, even regardless of the TCP window size you're using. And you get here to 60, 70 milliseconds. And a typical LA to New York latency on most carriers is around anywhere from 60 to 80 milliseconds. So for cross-country replication, you're looking at something around this area of the graph. So no matter what kind of line you bought, you're not going to get a whole lot of bandwidth through it. So you've got to be careful here. A big thing, look at the effect of TCP window size. So a big thing to take from here is make sure you are setting your TCP options and your replication engine properly to take advantage of the TCP window. Another important point here is this is per TCP session. So that the limit of the bandwidth is per session based on the window size. So you also want to make sure that your replication mechanism can initiate multiple TCP sessions so you can flood your pipe. So if you have a 100 megabit link from LA to New York, you can utilize the full pipe, but you have to be able to initiate multiple TCP sessions, big window size, so you can get concurrent traffic going across it. Otherwise, you're just wasting the pipe. So some of our conclusions that we learned from this. The first thing we came across is we knew VMware. When we got VMware, it was for server mitigation. We didn't want to buy any more servers. Only about a year after we started learning all the ins and outs of ESX, we realized, hey, this thing is great for DR. And then it was only after we did our first round of DR, we said, you know what, we need something a little bit better. And storage virtualization really simplified our ability to do DR and failover. It solved a lot of problems for us, got rid of all the resource utilization. We literally would have, with 30 sites and X number of servers per site, we would see the software-based replication mechanism cause a problem on a server, certainly weekly, if not more often, because there's a lot of servers out there. So this got rid of all those problems. We no longer care if we reboot servers because it does not affect replication in any way, shape, or form. So that was a big plus. Now, nothing is perfect. We learned a hard lesson when we had to fail over one of our offices not even as an exercise. They were losing power and we failed them over. And when we failed them over the data center, we forgot to turn off our disk defragmentation utility that runs every Saturday night. And come Sunday morning when we were going to fail them back to their office, we saw gigabytes. I forgot what the number was.
400.
Yeah, it was a huge number of gigabytes of IOs. I'm like, okay, these guys did a lot of work this weekend. I was really shocked. And after we thought about it for a little while, we realized, no, they didn't work that hard. We left the disk defragmenter on. And as far as the system's concerned, it's I.O. It tracked them, and it had to replicate them. So not a big deal. We just had to let it run a little longer to replicate that stuff in the other direction, and everything came back up.
In that situation, we filled back every other server except the file server. We ran Monday off the data center on that file server. We ran everything else, Exchange, SQL, everything else off the site Monday night. I asked for permission to put the window of time, did the last thing, took 2 minutes, moved the file server over.
And that was the last line there. Our mechanism right now is very easy to fail over a whole subnet. However, it does not preclude you from failing over a single server. You can do that. It just takes a little more effort. In that case, we actually had to change the IP address of the server so we could stay in a different subnet while the rest of the subnet failed back over to the office. So it's all doable. It just depends on the amount of effort that you want to expend on it. Okay. So when we first went through all this effort, our number one concern was DR. But after we were going through it, we discovered that there are a lot more uses for this than just DR. And so far, we failed over offices twice, and none of them were for true disaster. They were both for cases where the office, the building itself, was doing their annual maintenance on their electric switchgear, and they shut off the power to the building. So office maintenance is a great reason to do this. Upgrades. Now, if we have to upgrade, let's say we're going to upgrade the LAN infrastructure in the office, or even the server infrastructure in the office, we fail over the servers into the data center. We go through and rip out all the LAN stuff, or we rip out all the whole server stack out of the rack and replace it with new quad core, quad CPU, whatever servers, and then move everything back. It's VMware. It doesn't care what the hardware was, so we just move the stuff back and forth, and then no one had to stop working over the weekend, and everything ends up the way it was on Monday morning. Office moves. We had a situation where one of our offices was moving. Unfortunately, it wasn't one of those that we had installed this technology in yet, but this would have been great for an office move. An office is moving. We just move it to the data center for the weekend, let them move the physical equipment to the new location, bring them back up. Testing is also a great one. We have done this also multiple times now since we've been replicating our data. We have been able to take an entire office. There was a situation in one of the offices that we had a question of something going on in the Exchange server. We took the domain controller and the Exchange server and a client for that office, stood them up in the data center using the snapshot copies that were replicated, put them in a private LAN, accessed that through VMware, and we were able to do testing on the live system without actually testing the live system. So that was really, really useful to do. And that's it. So now we open the floor up for questions. And if you could please come up to the mic and ask the questions, that way they're recording the session and they can keep track of that. Yep.
Can you elaborate a bit how you structure your network, like LAN, the IP address, and those things that allow you to happen?
So the question is how we put the network together IP-wise to let this happen. So like I said, we've got a Class A network using a 10 addressing scheme that we subnet down to the Class C level, so a /24-bit mask. And we made sure that the addresses are unique anywhere in the network, and we made sure that the VLAN IDs are unique anywhere in the network. So when we move the VLANs from one location to another, literally there's a couple commands on one router to say, shut down this VLAN interface, and on the other router, turn it back up over here, and then we turn RIP on the interface, and that's it. In a few minutes, all the network is aware of the change, the new route is advertised out, and you can literally just ping the servers. They come right back up.
So you make a VLAN and all those IPs give it to you over your LAN.
Yep. Yes. Yep.
attach yourself, like BSS clients or?
Good question. So the IP store appliance we're using would take the snapshot no matter what. However, they have agents that you can install. They have a SQL agent, an Exchange agent, an NTFS agent you can install on the machine. It's not required, but if you install it, it will quiesce the I.O. before it takes a snapshot, and that will guarantee that it's transaction consistent, and that's the way we do it.
The second question is that I agree that you don't want to be replicating data that isn't recovered, like a block file or a temporary, but you do need that presence at the target site. So how do you get that across initially, and how do you react to any changes that are made at the primary to reflect that at the secondary?
So the bad news is that our first go-around at this, we actually replicated them, and it results in a little more replication I.O. than we had hoped. And so we're changing it over now so that there's two ways you can do it. You can either, for example, so this is now a good use for VMFS. You can create just a VMFS partition and put a few VMDKs that have these things. And at that point, you can just replicate them once. There's two ways to do it. You can replicate it once and just have the copy over there and present it to the DR server. Or you can create a new one. You can script it on the other end using something like diskpart, present that thing to the OS, and then bring it up that way.
With the IP store product, that virtualization probably been very successful in your environment. Have you since standardized on your storage hardware, or do you rely on that virtualization to give you the flexibility to go with best breed whenever you need it required?
We have not standardized. The question is, have we standardized our storage hardware in spite of having a virtualization appliance? We have not, and we probably will not. And in fact, this probably encourages us not to, and to have even more variety of storage. I can see going forward using a wider variety of storage in the back end. And the nice thing is that we've seen it's very easy now with a virtualization appliance to move from one type of storage to another. You can literally have, so let's say we have an office that has been running on a SCSI array for a long time, and we're about to install a SAN. So you can take the LUNs that you were running virtualized behind the virtualization appliance on SCSI array, mirror them to the SAN. The host can stay up in most cases. Cut over the LUN to the new SAN, get rid of the old LUN, and the host never even goes down. So there's a lot of things that these appliances bring to the table to facilitate not just DR but all these other storage operations. So going forward, you know, there's no. We want the best, cheapest storage we can get, and cheap. You know, you want to get the cheapest per gigabyte cost you can on storage. And now it's nice. We don't have to care about storage. We have a consistent interface. We can buy whatever makes sense for that office. And our problem is we have, again, the small offices and the big offices. And we will probably have small offices for a long time, so we're never going to be able to standardize the storage. Yes, we do. The question is, do we quiesce the Exchange database? We're using the IP store Exchange agent to quiesce it.
You're doing that every 15 minutes?
We're doing it every 15 minutes. And the unasked question that the look he's got on his face is, what is the impact on that of performance? And yes, there is a potential impact on performance. Have we noticed it? I can't say we have noticed nothing. There is an occasional effect on that. However, with Exchange, that's going to go away in the future. With Outlook 2003, Exchange 2003, and all future versions, cache mode makes that completely go away. You don't care if the server slows down for just a second. The clients never even notice it. Now, we are not using cache mode everywhere, and it still isn't really a problem. Can I say it's been noticed on occasion? Maybe, but it's not a big deal. Have we had any issues with it? I think the biggest issue is just the learning curve. It's not exactly a tiny product. It does a lot of things. Like I said, we bought it for replication, and that's how we were originally using it. And after we started rolling out, we said, hey, this thing does some pretty cool stuff. And now we're starting to think of a lot more things we can do with it. And maybe if we had had more time to play with it before we actually put it in production, we may have designed things a few differently. It's not really a problem with the product. It's really a design situation. You always want to change the way you designed your system after you've gone through version one. And we're going to make some changes the way we deployed the disk. We're going to split up the RDMs a little bit, things like that.
No critical issues, no showstoppers.
We are not using clusters. We had clusters in the past, and they were more of a pain than they were worth. And we have discovered that with VMware, in our environment, and this doesn't apply to everyone, I realize that, but in our environment, all the applications that we have can tolerate a couple minutes of downtime. So from our point of view, it's okay to shut a VM. If a physical host dies, the VM can be down for a couple minutes in the amount of time it takes to bring it up somewhere else. And now, going forward with the VI3, HA is going to take care of that for us as well. It'll do that automatically. So we're okay with a couple minutes, from a few seconds to a few minutes of downtime. We're looking at that. We don't have any right now. The only compression we're doing is we're doing compression at the storage appliance level. So the IP store box actually does compression between the two boxes. The other nice thing is that graph that I put up with the WAN latency, that's a big issue, like going from an LA office to the data center. But luckily, the IP store box will initiate multiple TCP streams, so you can actually pound the pipe pretty hard when you want to. Now, going forward in Europe and Asia and some of these really, I mean, we're about, what, 180 milliseconds away from Europe in some cases, and Asia is even farther. We're probably going to have to look at something like that to help reduce the latency issue even further. But that's going to be not just for replication, but it's also going to be for all sorts of other applications too. Yep.
Does the WAN module have encryption?
The WAN module does have encryption. We have chosen at this point not to use it. No, go ahead.
So we're not using VMUKs anymore. It's all strictly RDM. We have one RDM per server, except for Exchange and SQL. We split up the RDM. But everything is one RDM. Physical.
But that doesn't matter. You can do a logical RDM too. And going forward with VI3, it's going to be a logical RDM. So the question is, what kind of router are we using? Since we're using RIP V2, it follows the lowest cost. So the question is, like, are you saying, do we P to V these things? So at the time we were implementing VMware, we were also upgrading our servers at the same time, so that was an opportunity to refresh them. So we installed them from scratch in a virtual environment. We did not P2V anything. All the remote sites, all the production servers run on ESX, and the only exception to that is there's a physical box attached to a tape drive to do backup, but it doesn't host any production servers.
We took the our old VMUK, and we actually use VMS tool to import, or using DD to import onto an RDM.
Yeah, the nice thing is in 2.x you can use DD, and 3.31 you have to use VMKFS tool to import a VMDK to an RDM. So it's actually not that hard if you're considering using RDMs for various reasons, and you have a bunch of VMDK now. It takes a certain amount of time to copy it, but literally you create the RDM, use VMKFS tools to copy them back and forth, and you can do this all day long. It's a pretty easy operation. The only downside is the downtime it takes to do the copy. You have a question? We were using DocsOpen before, and we're using iManage now. It works pretty good. We've got, at this point, we have the bulk of our users converted to iManage, and we have our two largest offices converted to iManage. And they're all running completely virtualized. And so our biggest office is about 600-something users, and it works fine. We're running a decentralized model, yeah. And we're running, so with iManage, you run multiple DMSs and multiple IDX servers in different VMs, and that helps alleviate the load.
You virtualize to 95%. How did you handle the vendors that would not support, would not give you any kind of positive statement about their support of their product in a VM environment?
So there's three techniques you can use for that. One, you don't tell them. Number two, you lie like hell. And number three, you say, this is what we're going to do. and you can either sell us a product or not. And one of those three usually works.
Usually we don't, you know, you're not asking for help.
Do you have any applications or products that you found did not perform adequately for you that you backed them out of the effort?
So the question is, do we have something that didn't work in VMware? The short answer is no. The longer answer is we've had a couple interesting situations. Early on in the deployment of it, we had one of those situations where I thought, oh my goodness, what have we done? And we had a couple servers. All of a sudden one day, a couple servers started blue screening in the middle of the day. Now, the really neat thing about that was that, so it was the main file server, and the file server was blue screening in the middle of the day, and nothing else was, it was running on the same machine as all the other stuff, and all the other ones stayed up. So that was great. What we later discovered is that our backup backup manager had upgraded the backup agent on those things, and that didn't like our antivirus software. And so once we fixed that little problem, it was fine. But the really cool thing is we were blue screening a server a couple times a day right next to three other servers, and nothing happened other than that one server. So it was a gut check moment, but it wasn't VMware's fault. So no, we have not had anything that didn't virtualize well. Now, having said that, there are a couple apps, most of them having something to do with Java, that just consume all the resources on the box, and we had hoped to virtualize them, and there wasn't much point because they were just pegging the box no matter what we did, and so we put them back on physical boxes. But it wasn't an operational issue, it was more a performance issue. And so when I say 95%, haven't we virtualized? One big SQL server that has 32 gig of RAM, another SQL server that has 16 gig because at the time we couldn't do 16 gig of RAM, but now we're probably going to virtualize it on VI3, and a couple of Exchange MTAs that just run, they don't even have local storage, they're just running like mad all the time. It wasn't worth doing that. And then we have two domain controllers in our data center that are just local disks, and the reason they're not virtualized is we got tired of shutting down these domain controllers every time we had to do a SAN upgrade. So no matter what these SAN vendors tell you, there's no such thing as a non-disrupted upgrade. We had to bring everything down because of that. So we there's a couple things that are not virtualized, but not because they couldn't be, they just don't make sense in our environment. Any other questions? A combination. They're mostly private lines. The vast majority of them are private lines. One of the European links is a VPN, and the Tokyo office is a VPN right now. It's a big problem. Yeah, so we have the Citrix Secure Gateway as the web interface to it, and we have a bunch of presentation servers behind that. And that's
all virtual.
Not all of them. There's a couple physical ones. It depends on the load on them. But we have a boatload of virtualized Citrix servers.
What parts are you putting up in field type to have whatever?
A pretty standard remote site. They're all 2U, two proc boxes. The real sweet spot now that the multi-cores are coming out. So right now we love the dual proc dual cores, and I'm really looking forward to the dual proc quad cores. Those are going to be really, really sweet. We've been using the DL385s that let us load up 16 gig of RAM and those things. So the 16 gig of RAM and four cores works really well in the remote office. We have some quad CPU boxes in the data center. Yes? Right now, it's we haven't migrated that to storage virtualization yet. Even if it's physical, doesn't matter. You can still put it on storage virtualization and replicate that data across. We're going to do that in the next couple of weeks. You can boot from SAN.
We do have it.
So there's two ways to do that. One way is you boot from SAN. The other way is that Falcon Store has a product called DiskSafe that lets you basically you can back up. Any drive, it doesn't matter whether it's on a SAN or not, or it doesn't matter whether it's using the storage virtualization appliance or not, you can back this thing up and replicate it as well. And what you do is it replicates to one of the IPv4 boxes, and you can replicate this thing anywhere you want to.
You guys replicate your support data?
We have not started doing that yet, so obviously you know a little bit about law firms, and Summation is probably our biggest consumer of lit support data. And we've got 650 gigabytes of that. Is that what it's up to now? Has he exceeded that already?
More than that.
Okay. And so that's in the works. We're moving. We're getting our lift support people to move that to a new set of LUNs, and then we're going to replicate those once he's done. The nice thing about that is that's a huge blob of data that doesn't change a whole lot. So once we get it across, it'll be fine. But it's the initial replication, we'll probably have to ship tapes to the other data center and restore them, and then just mirror sync them across. Yep. To expand a couple different ways to do it.
You can go to the IP Pro console, right click on the SAN resource, select expand, either expand the RDM at that point. You can down the server. On 2003, you can actually do a rescan of your disk manager. It'll find the new space, and you can use this part, reuse this part, and expand it on the fly.
Or you can present it at that point. You can present the Windows and another drive and mount point, or, you know, there's a couple different ways to do that.
RDMs they give you a much bigger playing field out there. You can present your servers to a laptop. I mean, via iStudy, I can bring an Exchange server into my laptop and see what's going on with that database. You can, in backup purposes, I don't have to go to tape anymore. I can just present a snapshot to my, you know, local tech and say, here, restore from this mount point.
That's a great point. That's the way that the remote offices recover data. We can take a snapshot of anything that we have out there, and through iSCSI, the local technician out there can bring it up to the desktop, and because there are snapshots, you can pick, hey, okay, I want yesterday, I want today, I want 3 o'clock yesterday, I want 4 o'clock today, whatever you want of when the snapshot was taken, and then present that via iSCSI to their desktop, and they can just browse the file system of the file server and pick out the file they wanted. If they don't want that, they pick another snapshot and find the thing that they were looking for.
Hopefully next year at VMworld, we'll be presenting on no backup.
that's our goal for next year, is no tape backup. So.
That's the goal that he's presented to the table. And let's get rid of tape. So we're going to hopefully do it all with Matt. They want no backup.
All right, they're waving a sign at me back there. We got to go. One more question. Right. Exactly. Small office has a 3 or 4U SCSI array. We attach IP store to it via SCSI, and now the ESX sees it as a fiber channel storage appliance. It doesn't know what it is, and IP store will replicate that data. You can put literally any kind of storage, SCSI, SATA, SAS, into a storage appliance and then replicate that across the WAN. Yeah, we do not, because it's ESX, right? So we have a couple of ESX servers, and the only thing they have in there are boot drives, and then all the data is on one SCSI storage array, and that is on the virtualization appliance, and that we can replicate out. All right, thank you very much, everybody.